Hey, Adam.
Yes, Mike.
Yay! Cheering is back. Woo! And it's audible.
I was just going to start the show with a clap, in honor of 3 years of clap-only crowds, mostly, I'll say, being over in Japan, as cheering crowds are now the norm. Thank God. I don't know that anyone consumed more clap crowd wrestling than you and I over the past 3 years. I know I've watched more than I care to admit. I could handle it more than I think you could, but I got to the point to where once we started having some cheering crowds over the past 3, 4, 5 months, watching the shows with just clap crowds was really, really difficult. So thank God.
Man, I have this really nasty joke about filthy Tom Lawler and some ex-girlfriends of him in a clap crowd, but I'm not going to lower myself to those levels, especially not this early in the show.
I thought we were going to play an old Scotty Anton promo from ECW.
Yeah, it was like giving a junkie a little taste, and then it was like I got to be all back over this again. I did not like the clap only crowd, but I did accept it because that's the situation we were in. But as different jurisdictions across the world started to drop that, and we did start hearing, the audible response again, I won't take it like, Will Ospreay did, where he was just he flummoxed that anybody could even watch any of this stuff. But pro wrestling is a spectator sport, and it is a what did Vince McMahon used to say at the beginning of those WWF shows? Discretionary viewer participation is suggested. You need the crowd. You need it more in pro wrestling than many, many other sports. And I'm happy it's back. I'm happy it's back in full. Hopefully, the truly the worst of all of this stuff is over and gone and done with for right now, at least until the next thing that comes into Texas.
Yeah, we'll see. It's weird looking back sort of on these past 3 years where you had so many promotions, so many companies, whatever you want to say, that did not lean into what could still work in terms of the type of wrestling that could still work, more hard hitting, mat wrestling, whatever you want to say. And just kept trying to do much more fan participation type of wrestling without the fan participation. I'm looking at New Japan in particular. I can't imagine 5, 6, 7 years from now, particularly if we don't hit another pandemic of some sort and we're back to normal wrestling crowds on the regular. I can't imagine how weird it's going to feel going back and watching stuff from this time period, particularly the stuff that didn't really work, House of Torture, which we've talked about ad nauseum. I can't fathom what would make me 4 or 5 years from now want to go back and watch stuff that felt like I was being tortured watching it in real time. But yeah, just a strange period of wrestling in Japan that, while we had a ton of great matches, and the great matches were still easy to watch, like your rank and file undercard stuff or your really heavy heat-based heel babyface sort of stuff was a chore to get through. And like we both said, seemingly we're finally on the other side of that. And really, this past weekend, the shows that took place, whether it be Dragon Gate, New Japan, Stardom, All Japan, Pro Wrestling Noah, among other companies, they all felt like the return to pro wrestling in Japan and the type of crowds and crowd reactions in Japan that, I think we had all come to, enjoy and, take for granted. I think about Corkin Hall and how incredible of a crowd response building that's always been. And then we just had nothing for 3 years and now it's back. And I'm back in that mode where I don't care what promotion it is. I almost don't care what card it is. Anything from Corkin Hall is going to be worth watching.
Well, there's enough shows that take place there every week where it's
True, true.
yeah, I mean, it's again, it's we don't have to go back and rehash. I am interested. It will be interesting to see 10, 20 years down the road how people look at these matches and how new eyes look at them and how they digest them and some of the stories that we get afterwards, you know, of, you know, well, COVID really screwed us up there. Wait a second. You didn't have to run that angle that poorly, whether there were people there or not. That was a big fat failure. So it'll be interesting to see how all the stories play themselves out over the next God knows how many years and decades down the line. But one thing we got, like you mentioned, at the top of the cards, you know, those matches, again, yes, the crowd participation not being there in some cases or clap only is going to be something that you're going to have to take in as you're watching it. But, you know, when it comes to the really good matches, you know, you watch stuff on demand, you watch old tapes, old footage, you know, things like that. I mean, if you're into what you're watching and they've got you into what they're doing in the ring, I'm not saying that you forget about the crowd, but you do start to zero in on them as if you're watching at home or you're watching on the computer or something like that, you know, it's when it really failed miserably is when it really stood out, like the evil stuff and a lot of the King of Pro Wrestling stuff and a lot of that sort of nonsense. So yeah, it is going to be fascinating as we go down the line now that everything is, you know, opened back up again, you know, CMLL. They finally announced the official lineups for Fantasticamania, which we were robbed of last year. So again,
the last few years.
God, that's right. It has been the last couple of years now. So, you know, I don't know. I was surprised to not see Rocky Romero, to be honest with you, on these shows. And granted, I know he's tied up doing a lot of things, but I am a little surprised that he didn't have any position on those CMLL shows that were announced, especially with what's going on between him and Volador.
Yeah, I would 100% agree. To me, that's, you know, with Rocky Romero winning, what was it, the historic welterweight championship?
Yes, the CMLL. NWA historic welterweight championship.
I was disappointed that he's yet to capture the NWA futuristic championship, but that will come apparently at another time.
That'll be in Nakalapana for IWRG. I think they got the rights to that one.
There you go. That actually feels like a GCW title, to be honest. But yeah, I mean, that is the main thing that stands out on these cards to me is the absence of Rocky Romero. You'd think, honestly, I assumed he would be on given him winning the title in CMLL, his familiarity wrestling all these guys.
Defended it on the cruise.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. You'd figure if he defended it on the cruise, he'd defend it at Fantasticamania, but that's not the case. A lot of the guys I think we would have expected. To me, the most interesting thing is always on the New Japan side, what guys will be on these cards. We've got all the Young Lions, that being Yuto Nakashima, Ryohei Oiwa, and Kosei Fujita represented here. You have LIJ. Tetsuya Naito is always on these cards. He's like the only top guy that doesn't get a tour off, it feels like. Hiroshi Tanahashi, prominently featured as he kind of, you know, we've seen the slow progression of him down the card in New Japan, but he's prominently featured here in this tournament and or on this tour. We've got an interfaction tag team tournament going on throughout the tour. And then there's one title match, that being the CMLL World Welterweight title, the second to last night of the tour at Corican Hall with Titan taking on Soberano Jr., also Volador Jr. against Templario on that card. And then the last match, the main event of the final night is Mystico against Atlantis Jr. So it'll be a fun change of pace. It'll be cool to see Doki and El Desperado mixing it up with all the CMLL guys. It's another sign of things getting back to normal when we have this really fun, colorful palate cleanser of a tour early on in the New Japan calendar year.
Yeah, man, what a way to bookend these shows with main events, too, because it opens up with Hiroshi Tanahashi and Mystico against Ultimo Guerrero and Atlantis Jr., and then closes with the Mystico-Atlantis Jr. match at the end at Corican Hall on February 28th. So you know there's going to be some really good wrestling. I know this is – I take the World Tag League off. A lot of people have taken Fantasticamania off. It'll be interesting to see, though, if there is a little more interest in it this year or if it is up a little bit compared to the last couple years that it ran just because, you know, hey, yeah, how can you miss something if it doesn't go away? Well, now it went away. Let's see if people are missing some of their great junior heavyweights and fun lucha action.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty safe bet. I mean, we also you know, there's all the shows that are listed, at least, are all going to be on New Japan World. So that's, you know, let's see, 22nd, 23rd, 3, 4, 5, 6 shows, Fantasticomania on New Japan World. And it's also a fun way, you know, as far as just New Japan doing different things or things that have felt different from these 3 years of pandemic era sameness, we have Fantasticomania, and then that flows right into the Hiromu Takahashi Junior Festival, which will be a pay-per-view event on New Japan World March 1st. I believe what I've seen is that it will be the first time New Japan World will live broadcast a show in 1080p. So hopefully that will become the norm, and we'll start to see picture quality on New Japan World that is up to the same level that we see from Wrestle Universe.
Since we did the show 7 days, 10 days ago, whenever it was, had we talked about the fact that New Japan Strong would be going away? Or the they decided to go with the New Japan Strong on-demand service?
I think we touched on it. I have to go back and listen. But yeah, the idea that New Japan Strong as a show, as its own freestanding show, is going away, and that instead they will be doing, it seems, monthly iPay-per-views, and then if you don't want to spend the money or can't spend the money on the iPay-per-view, they will be rolling out the matches from those iPay-per-views on a weekly basis on New Japan World, kind of as a TV show. So, you know, it's different. I mean, really, I think in the end, we're going to get bigger shows and better matches, because you're not going to have, I mean, if you're doing a pay-per-view every month, you're going to have fairly high-profile, important matches on those shows. Not to say that the Strong TV show wasn't entertaining, because it was, but there was a lot of filler on those shows. A lot of times the first couple of matches on each show would be, you know, would not necessarily have a whole lot of relevance to New Japan as a whole, or even to in New Japan Strong storylines. Whereas now, if you're doing a pay-per-view every month, you know, the first maybe one, two matches on the show are going to have, you know, a real undercard feel, but you figure the last five, six matches on the show are all going to be, you know, pretty relevant and pretty significant. So I'm looking forward to see how, you know, how it plays out starting next weekend with the, I assume that's, it'll start with Battle in the Valley, where that'll be a pay-per-view, and then those matches will be rolled out on New Japan World, but I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, there's a lot I'm very interested in, if people are, because we don't know the Stardom numbers for the pay-per-views, you know, and I'm sure if we asked, they would say, well, they're doing pretty good, you know, because they're not going to give us any numbers on any of that sort of stuff. I do have a concern about basically spreading the pie too thin across the board and microtransactioning everybody to death, you know, with Fight TV, and you spend $4.99 over there. You got IWTV, you got New Japan World, the premier service has started up. You know, it's like, boy, you know, I look at where ROH, and man, remember about the deal of New Japan. We'll find out right after January 4th about how they're going to work together.
Interesting aspect of all of this is that we were supposed to be getting news right after the Tokyo Dome of, you know, Honor Club and there being significant New Japan involvement. And maybe that's still to come, but it sure feels like the trail went really, really cold on that right around the time that they built up to this announcement of the shift in New Japan Strong to these pay-per-views. It's, yeah, it, to me, the only real loser from this switch, potentially, and it's significant, maybe not significant to fans, but to me, it's to the wrestlers, because New Japan Strong, well, they ran, what, like once a month, they did the TV tapings. A lot of independent guys got opportunities on that show and then parlayed that into, you know, wrestling on AEW Dark, wrestling, you know, in Impact, you know, even guys like Bad Dude Tito coming out of nowhere to, you know, be a featured member, at least for a time, of a stable. You know, we'll see if he is a TMDK member going forward, as they've really honed in on that being ZSJ and, you know, Shane Haste and Mikey Nichols. But, you know, that would be the only thing that I sort of look out for is, are we going to see less opportunities for for wrestlers coming out of this new form of Strong and New Japan in the U.S.
Yeah, and you know the dojo guys as well too. You know, and you know Kevin Knight, Bad Dude Tito, Kratos, Limelight, Ross, even Filthy. You know, look at the opportunity that Filthy had because of the pandemic. Again, one of the silver linings of the pandemic. Well, all of this stuff had to happen, and look what we were able to get out of that with Filthy and Team Filthy and everybody that was associated there. The matches that we got that were really good. Fred Rosser has been really good. So, yeah, it's like, okay, with this new deal, what happens there? You know, what happens with that Strong championship? You know, do we see it go off of Rosser and onto Kenta so they can take it back, you know, to Japan or whatever it's going to be? It is going to be really interesting to see what happens here going on. And I don't know. I still think New Japan and ROH need each other in this, in this country desperately, but we'll have to see what happens.
Well, the other interesting thing too, and I'm sure this was already in the works and maybe it's not related, but right at the time where it feels like maybe the New Japan Ring of Honor trial has gone a little cold, we're seeing more and more participation and cooperation between New Japan and Impact, whether it be that basically now being the home of Yuya Uemura, you know, on his excursion, seeing more of Kevin Knight and Kushida teaming up in Impact. And then the announcement of the New Japan Impact show as part of the WrestleMania weekend coming up, I believe, on March 30th with Speedball Mike Bailey against Will Ospreay, Josh Alexander against Kushida. You know, it's a really interesting time because New Japan usually, historically, has always liked to have, you know, one partner sort of in each area. You know, it was ROH for a long time. It was, you know, WCW before that. You know, obviously CMLL, and now we're at a phase at a point where New Japan works with AEW. They work with Impact very closely. You know, Ring of Honor. You know, it's in many ways it's a very, very interesting time, both for New Japan and having partnerships domestically and overseas.
We're not going to have Bully Ray back in the Tokyo Dome, are we?
Oh God, I still haven't gotten over having to have him in Madison Square Garden.
Oh,
wait,
was he
there? Was he there? Or am I? Yes. Did I just make that up? What did he do there?
Oh God,
the street fight, Juice Robinson, yeah. That tag garbage, yeah. Oh God, I was like, I blocked out of my mind, and then it came back, and I'm like, did I make that up? No, he was there for that.
It's. You know, Kushida seems to be a regular there, although I guess I'm not sure of what exactly Kushida's contract status is exactly either, you know, to be honest.
Kushida's an interesting case, too, because, like, he's in New Japan, but he's living in L.A. He's doing a lot at the dojo, and as things have gone so radio silent on Katsuyori Shibata, other than he can't get booked for a match in New Japan to save his life, he doesn't seem to be particularly thrilled about that. It sure as hell feels to me like we're quietly moving toward a scenario where Kushida's the head trainer at the New Japan LA Dojo and this New Japan Academy that they just launched.
That's a really great point because, you know, we've speculated and kind of talked about, well, you know, what if Shibata goes because he wants to wrestle and they're not going to let him and he goes out there and he does his thing? How do you replace, you know, what he was doing there? Do you bring a Nagata or a Nakanishi or somebody over who's in Japan and have them rotate, you know? But I would be, especially if Kushida's living out there, he's comfortable living here, you know, I would rather, you know, Kushida be in that position as opposed 100%. To a lot of other guys, you know, especially because they have a, with the kids that are coming in too, again, you know, and I say kids because I'm, you know, going to be 47 years old here in a couple
of
weeks.
We're old men here.
Yeah,
you're going to be 47. I'm going to be 42. Jesus.
So yeah, it's God. But you know, but because of that, and because, you know, again, these kids are growing up with, again, it's a lot easier, I would think, to be able to relate to a Kushida as opposed to a Liger,
Manabu
Nakanishi, or any of the older guys that are there, and vice versa.
Yeah, I think it. It would be the perfect fit. Obviously, losing Shibata from the dojo would be a massive, massive loss. We've talked in detail, you know, about what he's done. But, you know, if you're going to have to put someone else in that spot, if it gets to that point, Kushida would certainly seem to be the right guy. I guess since we're on the topic of New Japan right now, kind of the elephant in the room, we haven't talked about it yet on the show, but I think it's the main takeaway from what I thought was otherwise a really, really good two nights in Sapporo. Shota Umino, not ready.
I think Kevin Kelly said it the best at the end. He'll be okay. But that match, in hindsight, at a half hour, was a big mistake. I'm trying to be too nice about it. He had a terrible performance.
It was a sink or swim moment, and he sank like a rock to the bottom of the ocean. I like Shota Umino.
Look, he didn't even have to... Look, it wasn't even sink or swim. He just had to bob there, and unfortunately, we didn't even get that. You know, me, there was that the light on Yo and on... And again, different points in their careers, but on Yo and on Umino this weekend, we'll get into it, but go ahead with your thoughts because, yeah, unfortunately, it didn't click. And then they had, you know, the in-ring issues and just, oh boy, it was a toughie.
It was the culmination to me of everything that's gone wrong with Shota Umino's career from the beginning of his excursion in Rev Pro till he got back through to that day. It all came to pass in this match. He's a guy who doesn't know who he is as a character. Is he copying Hiroshi Tanahashi? Is he copying Jon Moxley? Is he copying Stardust Genius Tetsuya Naito?
Dude, he's like a mix between Tanahashi and Naito to me.
He appears to be trying to do all three, but he's not doing any of them particularly well. The other issue is that and this is something that became very apparent right at the start of his excursion. I was hoping it would have changed, but it hasn't changed since he got back. His moveset is all wrong for his character.
Yeah.
Very little of what he does looks good. The double arm DDT is not a good finisher for him. That weird reverse neck breaker looks awful. So he's caught in between in so many different things. The other issue is, for a guy who, like, he's supposed to, like, the character is, you know, he's this valiant underdog babyface. He's like Bret Hart handing the shades out, but instead it's wristbands. It's all about, like, selling and comebacks. But his selling in this match, and it's not the first time we've seen this, is just all over the place. You mentioned in-ring that absolute disaster of a sequence where he completely got lost and could not recover. Naito had to grind it to a halt, and then they kept going. But after that point, Umino looked so rattled, like he'd get hit with a move, completely blank face, just get back up and take the next move, get back up and take the next move. He not only was that sequence bad, it felt to me like he panic froze. He had some fire towards the end of the match, but this whole thing, this entire match was structured to have the crowd start off favoring Tetsuya Naito because they're always going to favor Naito, but rally behind Shota Umino, and he just flat out didn't hold up his end of the bargain. Yes, it's not the end of the world, but the issue is that this isn't some one-off thing of, you know, mistakes he made in this one match. This was all the weaknesses that have been built up to over the last couple of years, having a really, really bright light shined on them at the worst possible time and him not being able to overcome it. So we'll see. Like, coming out of this, Mike, I got big Master Wato vibes for Shota Umino, and that's not what you're looking for when they clearly, desperately want him to be one of the top guys, one of the pillars going forward.
Yeah, and I have not been as down as you have been on the whole thing, but I watch kind of cringing. He's the shooter with Jon Moxley, and he's this kind of badass and giving up the middle fingers, and he's being influenced. And then when he comes back, it's like he's this mix between Tanahashi and Naito. And it's, well, okay, let's see how this goes. And we've seen this with almost everybody that's come back from an excursion. They always have a bumpy road at the beginning, whether it be, and this was brought up on commentary too, whether it be Okada or Goto or Watto or almost everybody. I mean, Evil, I was, you know, he probably had one of the better jumps, you know, with the character that he brought back because of the wackiness of it and the stable, you know, initially that he was in. It was like, okay, you know, in a weird way, he probably had one of the best comebacks, you know, from an excursion. But as you mentioned with Rev Pro, it's like, I was surprised he never did travel. Then he couldn't. And then he comes back and it's like, all right, there's something missing here. And then, as you mentioned, it just felt like that match was the bright shining light on everything that he does not do well or has not done well. There was more communication obvious in this match than I maybe any, and I'm not, it's, I'm sure there's been plenty in New Japan matches, but like it stood out to me for the first time in I don't know how long, maybe ever, that it was like, man, Naito's doing a lot of talking. There's a lot of covering the mouth. There's a lot of all of that. Oof. And that was, and wasn't just when things started bright, like it was from the beginning.
Absolutely.
So it's like, okay, I don't know what I think he's going to be fine. I don't know what the right answer is, but I think maybe getting a jump on having him sour on the fans, or maybe because they push, you know, they push that, how he could not rally the fans, and Naito's even trying to rally him for him, and he can't do that. So I don't know how the Japanese commentary portrayed it, but I wouldn't wait too long before, you know, the hair dye comes out, you know, the black hair goes, and he starts looking more like, frankly, it's Tsuchi Onita than this Stardust Tana thing that he's got going on.
There's a few things. First, he might just not be a top guy. Like, obviously, well, it's still possible. Very early on when he came back. He's a young guy. But he might also just not be good enough to be a top guy, which there's no shame in that. He might be an upper mid-card guy. But to your point, which I had not thought of this at all until you just mentioned this, kind of the light bulb went off in my head. If you really want to make a splash and you want to do something different, well, I would love to see Bullet Club cease to exist this year. Let's just say Jay White is on his way out. Let's just say he's losing to Hikuleo this weekend. You know, last match in Japan, and the idea of them saying only last match in Japan is because he still has the match with Eddie Kingston coming up at Battle in the Valley. And let's say Shota Umino, in a shock, takes over as leader of Bullet Club.
The problem with that is, if you're going to do that, then, well, one, you've now, Bullet Club would then, again, it was always a foreigner's kind of led thing. So to me, El Phantasmo should be the head of that monster. But if Umino is at his side or is one of those guys, you know, in the mix of this new reimagined, refocused, re-artworked, because I saw the New Japan gimmick game on the phone. I saw that El Phantasmo was making Bullet Club drawings and doing his own art for those cards in that game. So I would put him with him, and look, if he's got any douchebag characteristics, LP will bring it out of him, you know?
That is very true.
And he can play to the crowd, and maybe that's the answer. I'm not saying do that yet, but I wouldn't wait too long and have him basically, because you can't do what you did with Watto in the junior heavyweight division, because now it's like, Watto can just linger forever as Watto, like, with Umino, I don't think you can do that and have any good results come out of that. If you're going to, you know what I'm saying? So it's like,
well, yeah, you've already committed to the idea that this guy is one of your top guys going forward. So you can't let him linger. You have to figure something out. I see the idea of him as the leader of Bullet Club. It would be maybe the only thing they could do with Bullet Club that I would find interesting, in that it would be a break from the endless supply of foreigners leading the group. I mean, ELP as political leader, to me, it would make them really start to feel mid-card. And that's nothing against him, because when the shtick isn't too strong, he's a great wrestler. I don't know. The idea, like you said, of Shota Umino dressed up kind of like like at Tsuchi Onita, being the Bullet Club leader with the likes of ELP and, you know, whoever else they bring into that fold at his side. I don't know. It's an interesting thought. I just, anything significant that they do with Umino is at some point going to come down to him looking in ring like the top guy that they want him to be. And whether it be his excursion since he came back, or particularly here, I don't see it yet. Like, my thought watching this match, Mike, is right now, Ryohei Oiwa or Kosei Fujita would have had a better version of that same match with Tetsuya Naito. And that's not a good sign when Shota Umino is long past his Young Lion stage, came back from excursion, and looked, I thought, worse than any of the current Young Lions, particularly Kosei Fujita and Ryohei Oiwa, would in that spot based on what we've seen from them in recent months.
I disagree with that, although I understand completely the point that you're making. But what I will say is, if he does, he better step it up, because, and he's very lucky, Narita is kind of in a little bit of a different realm right now as far as what he's doing. But like, once Yuya Uemura comes back,
and that's the thing.
Once Yota Tsuji comes back, because that's, look, if they could bring Yota Tsuji back just as Yota Tsuji, I don't think that they're going to, because nobody comes back from Mexico the same way.
He'll be the one, of any of the guys on excursion now, he's going to be the one that gets some sort of wacky character. I think Uemura will come back as Uemura, but yeah, Tsuji's going to come back as some evil level wacky guy. I fully believe Tsuji will come back as part of, or maybe a significant part of, LIJ.
And I hope that's the case. I hope that's the case, as opposed to being a part of Bullet Club, or a part of Evil's faction, or anything like that. I mean, but regardless of the character, like, if Uemura and Tsuji come back and they hit, and Narita is even just coasting at the same level he's at, and we're talking about Fujita and Oiwa, and we're talking about guys that we saw in Strong and at the dojo making more appearances because travel's a little bit easier. And granted, there's something going on worldwide with visas with everybody right now. So, you know, that may be jumping the gun here. But look, you know, then you start going, oh, he's going to start getting lost in the mix. Or he's only brought up when Moxley's around, or yeah, something like that. And that's going to be the other thing, too, is I wonder if, again, 10 years from now, well, we can look back and see. But it's like, man, because he's already been touched by Moxley, and his size, you brought up his arm length. That's another, his arm, that's the wrong finishing move with his body type too. It's, is that double arm? Those, it doesn't work.
Those tiny short alligator arms, or T-Rex arms. There's a lot for him to overcome.
Yeah.
And I think the point you made is a fantastic point, that this is the window for Shota Umino to be able to establish himself as a top guy, because he's got multiple dojo generations coming behind him that are surer bets than he is in ring. Yuya Uemura right now, and I say this almost every week we do the podcast, but it can't be said enough, if he was brought back from excursion tomorrow, he would be a top five wrestler in New Japan. He is that good. Yota Tsuji is super impressive. You know, particularly depending on what character they give him when he comes back, he's going to be a top guy. And then you've got Oiwa, who is his, you know, every time I see him more and more lately, when I see him, I think he looks and reminds me so much of Young Lion Hiroshi Tanahashi. You know, Fujita will probably be a junior, but clearly they have big plans for him given what they've already done with him joining TMDK. There's a very real potential for Shota Umino to be lost in the mix a lot sooner than I think people would expect. Like, he could be Goto'd a lot earlier in his career than Goto was.
Yeah, and look, we've always said it. Goto's had a fabulous career. We were both bullish on him when he came back with his new gimmick, but we saw... And look, and see, the one of the things with Goto was, though, as we talked about at length, you know, they started doing more IWGP title defenses at a time where, because, you know... Again, times had changed. They didn't change quickly enough with it, with as many defenses. So Goto was in that position where he would get to a point and then lose them all. And then that kind of, that gave him, you know, they built the ceiling, you know, on him where, you know, it's like with Umino, I don't, you know, hopefully we'll see how it goes, but you know, he may be building his own ceiling as opposed to one that they're building for him because too, you know, Okan isn't going to be, to me, goofy tag team Okan forever. Like, at some point, he's the type of guy with his size, you can give him a serious singles run. You look at, you know, so, and again, you mentioned this is a great time because not only is the door open, you got all the dojo guys behind you, look at the top of the cards. You know, honestly.
He's the one fresh guy. Everybody yeah. else outside of Will Ospreay, who's, you know, it's a little bit different situation there, but all the native guys, while they're all beloved, everybody's seen every possible combination of them except for wrestling against Shota Umino. So if he can come through, any big match that he has is going to be, in theory, should be really exciting. But here, this was the first one against Naito, and it was just a total faceplant.
I am moving my opinion on Shota Umino to hold. I'm not selling. I'm not buying. He's a hold right now, but I'm feeling kind of bearish. So
yeah, I would agree. He's a skeptical hold for me. I don't know if that's a phrase.
He's not robust, as Nick Khan would say.
I would agree there. You mentioned Yo, and I want to get to that match with Hiromu like in a second. The one thing I want to quickly bring up because I don't want it to be lost in the mix is that there's something going on with Sonata. I don't know. It's one of two things. Either he's actually leaving and he's losing a lot of these matches and finishing up, or we're seeing the beginnings of a story where Sonata leaves LIJ and becomes Hontai Sonata that, you know, Tanahashi and others have called for. He's dropping falls in matches where Bushi is his partner in those matches. There have been six-mans, eight-mans, where he's getting pinned, and there's a junior heavyweight member of his team there. So there's something going on there. They've even alluded to on commentary, Sonata feels a little stale. So just kind of put a pin. There's something else there where if he is staying and they're doing another story, that's another guy who we could see, you know, in a different spot. The other quick point I wanted to bring up, Mike, when we were talking about the potential of a heel Shota Umino, we've seen multiple times on recent matches, both matches on this weekend, where he's getting frustrated and shoving refs, including his own dad.
Hey, you know, not the worst. Boy, I tell you, him with, again, just him as a, his size is just so tough. Because he really is. He's a
junior heavyweight.
He's a junior heavyweight. Yeah, in a middleweight's body. He's unfortunately just not. It's like I wish he was just a little bit bigger or a little bit smaller. And I think that's another reason to me where as a kind of a slimy dirtbag slick heel or a violent heel or whatever, you know, being on the smaller side isn't gonna affect that. Now, is it time? And a lot of people will say, you guys have had this discussion for 15 years now. Is it time with Sonata to do either he handshakes himself out of LIJ and says, I'm going to do this for Muda and now I'm serious, I'm tired of being looking this way, or even if it's the violent turn on Naito and you use that to put him in the mix? Is this, if he's not leaving, mind you, is this the time to do something with him just because Kenny Omega can't be there all the time and, you know, Will Ospreay is going to be there, but again, not native, and, you know, you got Okada. Is this could that provide some spark? Because at least you know Sonata can go with everybody, including everybody at the top.
For me, 100%. I mean, I'm
bad question to you.
I'm in the tank on Sonata, and it's, yeah, to me, it's either do something different with them, one of the two scenarios you described, or let them walk and go somewhere else, because it just, and part of it is him and his motivation level, but yeah, it just feels like there's so much more there with him, and he's absolutely treading water and has been for a while. So yeah, I'm ready for a non-LIJ Sonata, and maybe you wait to pull the trigger on that till it's time to bring Yota Tsuji back, and you know that fills that spot in a creative way. But yeah, I'm definitely ready for something different with Sonata. Much like, and this is, I'll say this is as professional of a segue as I've ever done. Much like we've all been ready for something different with Yo, and for the light bulb to finally go off. And maybe this is instructive or a cautionary tale to not give up on Shota Umino. But Yo, we talked about it in recent months, the team in Junior Tag League with Leo Rush, not only in storyline, but in ring, seemed to completely unlock something from Yo. He was a changed wrestler, and the culmination of that was here on the 5th, main eventing in Sapporo against Hiromu Takahashi for the IWGP Junior Heavyweight title. This was an incredible performance by Yo. I thought this was by far the best he's ever looked. To me, this was him fulfilling the promise. Like, everything you thought he was capable of is this, like, junior heavyweight mix of a Tanahashi or a Kushida somehow mashed into one. It was all there. He looked so much more confident, just doing everything at the right times. If you would have told me that I was watching a Hiromu Takahashi Yo junior heavyweight title match, and by the end of the match, I'd be desperately cheering on my couch for Yo to somehow win, I would not have believed you. And that's where I found myself. I could not be more impressed by his performance here.
I tell you, going to work every day has got to be a lot easier when you don't have to look across the card and see House of Torture there. You know what I'm saying?
Valid point.
I'm sure that helped. And I'm sure, like, and again, you know, just being in there with Leo Rush and being in there with all of those guys that he was in there with too, and just being refreshed during that tag league, I hope that's got something to do with it. But I thought that was a great match. And I, you know, Ishii and Sabre was good, but Takahashi and Yo and Ospreay and Taichi, which we'll get to in a minute too, were... God,
what a match that was. That's not getting talked about a lot. Oh my God, that was awesome.
Those two matches were the two best matches off that New Japan show. And if you're limited on time and you only have a chance to watch a couple of matches, to me, those are by far the two to watch. And I'll just echo everything you said about Yo. What I'll also echo is something that we have been saying for a long time. Hiromu Takahashi can be a main eventer, whether he's got a junior title, heavyweight title, no title, doesn't matter. Hiromu Takahashi can be that guy. Obviously,
this show, his show, back-to-back nights in the same building. First night, Naito main eventing against Shota Umino with Will Ospreay and Taichi, semi-main event, 3,073 fans. The next night, to your point, Hiromu Takahashi and Yo main eventing, that drew 3,300 fans.
Yeah. And again, I don't know what the walk-ups were or anything like that, but it's like, yeah, you know, there's nothing. Maybe they were bought in advance and people went, oh, you know, I figure the second night's always better than the first night. Or so, you know, I have somebody broke with WrestleMania tickets, but they got to go to Mania. It's like they got to flip the coin on which ones they want to watch more. But it's like, you know, I thought it was, those were both really great matches. Might as well just talk about Taichi and Ospreay right now. That just four guys faction, which is really no different than what they had with Suzuki, except they've traded in some of their gear for suits and more dad-like presentation. But man, are we going to get like a different Doki here?
You know, man, talk about great matches. You mentioned Doki. Don't want to let it go unsaid. The Francesco Akira and TJP against Yoshinobu Kanemaru and Doki junior tag title match from the 4th was fantastic as well. That I would recommend people check that
out.
Yeah,
I meant Taichi there. I said Doki, but like, are we going to, we've seen, you know, some of the subtle changes that were made there, but like those, like that is again, as far as I was wondering how it was going to be, but it's like them as a mid-card faction or a lower mid-card faction, I am all for this.
100%. So much more enjoyable of a lower mid-card faction than the House of Torture, for
example. And Doki and Kanemaru, boy, I know I said what I said about those two singles matches. If you have a chance to watch a third, watch the Junior Heavyweight Tag Team title match, because TJP, for anything you could say about his personality or some of the things that he said outside the ring or any of that sort of stuff.
And there's a lot to be said. Don't get us wrong. There's a lot. It's fertile ground, to say the least.
Yes, but much like in the history of pro wrestling, there are lots of guys like that who also happen to be pretty darn good at pro wrestling. And
absolutely.
As a leader in the ring, as a teacher, as somebody that's been, I'm sure he was at the original Inoki Dojo, you know, for heaven's sakes, as Puma. So I'm sure he's doing something for the LA Dojo and helping out when he can. But like him, anything he can provide with Akira, their team has been great. I really have liked them together.
And tremendous.
Kanemaru and Doki. You know, we all had our Doki jokes when he came in.
He's freaking awesome.
Yeah, that's the thing, is in this role with Kanemaru, they complement each other great. I think, that was just a really, really good tag team match. And of all New Japan stuff, but that was by far, no offense to Sabre and Ishii or to the IWGP tag team title match, because that was very good as well too. But I mean, that was really fun to watch. In some ways it felt like it went longer than 20 minutes because of everything that they did, but it didn't feel like that watching.
It didn't drag.
It only felt like 10. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was nice to see on a bigger show like this. I think it's because it was spread over two nights. This didn't open and only get 11 minutes. It got 18:24, which is exactly as much as it should have gotten. Really the two shows as a whole in Sapporo, outside of, I feel like a lot of people probably didn't watch the shows if they heard, well, you know, Naito Umino sucked, and they kind of left it at that. There's some really good stuff, I think, that we just laid out that's absolutely, very much worth checking out. It's interesting, though. You look at those two cards, and then you look at what we've got coming up in Osaka, which is already sold out at Osaka Prefectural Gymnasium. Cheering fans in Osaka for the first time in 3 years for New Japan. This card is not... Okada, Shingo, is going to be awesome. You know, we talked about last week, like, unless they're going to get really bold and have Kaito Kiyomiya cost Okada the title here to really get Okada ready to go, wanting to fight him on the 21st. Unless they do that, you know, I think it's pretty clear Okada's going to win. But outside of that, there's not a whole lot to be all that excited about. You got Tama Tonga and El Fantasma for the Never Open Weight title. If it's just a straight match, it could be better than we're expecting, but I don't expect it to just be a straight match. We've got Hikuleo and Jay White, loser leaves Japan. Not particularly looking forward to that. We've got Narita, Desperado, Suzuki against Evil, Yujiro, and Sho, ostensibly for the Never Open Weight six-man tag titles, if the House of Torture agrees to defend. Tanahashi and Kenta, I want to be excited about it, but it's not really there right now with either of those guys at this point in their careers.
They
I'm sure it'll
ladders.
Be better. Yeah. Yeah. No, they don't. They do, but they don't. Wato and Taiji Ishimori, I can't be bothered to care about that. Shota Umino with Honma, Tiger Mask, and Taguchi against LIJ. Maybe the most interesting thing to me that could come out of that is if like Honma pins Sonata and that's Sonata's last straw.
Can you imagine? Yeah, really.
It would be great. I mean, Honma never wins. If you haven't beat Sonata, I mean, what could drive a guy who's pretty chill more crazy than losing to Honma?
Or even worse, lose via ass bump to Gucci. You know what I'm saying? Like, even more embarrassing, he trips backwards over Bushi, who's laying there, and then, you know, something like that. I mean, oh my God. Yeah, that would be something. Wato and Ishimori, I'm interested in, just because I thought Wato had a good four-way on the fourth. So it's like, you know, much like any of the times they're in any of these situations, here's the big, bright, shiny light, because, you know, this is kind of it. If you look great against Ishimori and get the victory, cool. I'm fine with you having an IWGP title shot, and I'm fine with the continuation and all that. But if it's, you know, one of those bad Wato, you know, the what's the opposite of master, the you know,
apprentice
the,
Wato.
Yes, if this is just apprentice Wato, then you know, I guess his die is going to be cast. The Tanahashi Kenta match is interesting because, you know, it's how much is it? Is going to be a lot of crappy American style? Is this all to play to the crowd and just have some fun before we get into the heavier part of the card? That'll be interesting. I have no interest in the 6-man tag titles other than, you know, Minoru Suzuki and Red Narita's interactions throughout it. And then you get to the
seemingly
top of
the card. Being a unified force now after the show on the 5th.
Yeah.
We'll see how that goes.
And that's, you know, again, so that means probably too Suzuki, you know, he's at least going to be a regular, if not full time, in New Japan. He's going to be around there enough where we can still, you know, attach the Lion name to him. But,
well, he's in a weird situation too, because he sort of has this, and it's not like they have a name or anything, and they're not Suzuki Goon, but this trio with Narita and Desperado.
Yeah.
But then he's very regular right now. Well, I guess I shouldn't comment on how regular he is, but he's regularly appearing in All Japan with this almost like other Suzuki Goon type stable of he, Hokuto Omori, and Naruki Doi. So it's an interesting time if you're a Minoru Suzuki fan, on top of the fact that he'll be coming back to North America for another spell pretty soon.
Well, and Despy too, you know, I don't know exactly what his status is right now as well too, because he seems like at least it was feeling like there for a little bit that we could see him spread his wings and again just freelance more, and again, well, this match will say a lot about what happens. As long as Ren Narita does not join House of Torture, though, everything should be okay.
God,
Hikuleo and Jay White, can there be a double pin here or something? I
kind of cheering for it, to be honest. And again, I love Jay White, but I've seen all that I need to see of upper top card Jay White, Bullet Club leader, IWGP champion. We talked about it on the last few shows. Ready to move on.
Yeah, and if it's him that goes because he's doing, you know, signing with WWE or signing with AEW, or he just wants to spend 6 months in the States or whatever it is, I hope when he comes back that all that stuff's gone and we have Jay White finally crying on the floor. Instead of being pissed off about something, he's crying for redemption, because, you know, I've seen all I wanted to see with him in Bullet Club and as a heel. And as you mentioned, it's just, I've seen it all. So I don't know what new coat of paint they can put on him if he doesn't get the victory here, you know. With Hikuleo, Tama Tonga, and Tangaloa, all three of them should probably be in WWE. I would really rather see that right now, and then they could always come back later. But, you know, that group there, again, Hikuleo and White right now is scheduled to be six, and the penultimate, you know, the semi-main is Tonga and Phantasmo for that never open weight title. And it's like, I can't see Tonga beating El Phantasmo, but I have a feeling those two matches are going to just, they're going to be intertwined somehow.
One will flow right into the other. I think that makes a lot of sense.
And then obviously the main event, Okada and Shingo. And I would love Shingo to be the IWGP heavyweight champion, except for the fact that he's the KOPW champion. And they are obviously leading towards the, you know, interaction between Okada and Kiyomiya. So Kiyomiya getting involved or showing up or being a distraction or being a thorn or a headache or something I'm all for that. Absolutely all for that. But
I'd be shocked if he doesn't, because as we pointed out last week, the next night, Pro Wrestling Noah is in the same building with Kiyomiya defending against Jack Morris. I can't fathom, whether it just be backstage or out in the ring, in the aisleway, that Kiyomiya isn't going to show up on the 11th at New Japan, and Okada isn't going to show up on the 12th at Noah. It all lines up too well.
Boy, I'd love to see Shingo show up in All Japan for a couple of days too, just for the hell of it. So,
think about how fun it was a couple of years back, right before he joined New Japan, when he did that. He did that champion carnival. I could go for that again.
Yeah, he came to the States for a little bit. Remember that? And it was like,
that's it. And particularly, well, I don't know how much time we'll have a chance to mention it, but All Japan right now, after losing Jake Lee, and it's obviously nothing's ever perfect in All Japan. He's got all the voodoo murders bullshit. But man, you go back to that tag title match from a few weeks ago, and then the awesome match with Kento Miyahara and Yume Aoyagi for the Triple Crown that took place this past weekend, where still Yume Aoyagi did not win the Triple Crown. At some point, they have to pull the trigger there. But man, sneakily, All Japan in-ring is having an awesome start to the year, which I don't necessarily think that was on a whole lot of people's radar.
No, and let's see how sustainable it is well, too, but
it's like four guys.
Yeah, I mean, they absolutely started it off right. That is for sure. And Yume Aoyagi, that the only reason I can't complain about them not switching the belt is because you know the people will still be behind him the next time he goes in there to go after it. And that's it. It was I've made a lot of fun about half hour matches with Miyahara at times. But this was, again, it was a fast 28 minutes. The crowd loved both of them. They were, especially when it was time for Aoyagi to come firing back. You know,
vocal crowd, we should mention again, cheering crowd in Hachioji. Nice. What I think they had like 1,300-1,400 people, little balcony, great crowd reaction. I think you mentioned Miyahara's long matches, having crowds that can cheer and be into the matches. It made you realize how important that element is in a really, really, really good Kento Miyahara Triple Crown match.
So that's one. Definitely go out of your way to watch that one if you have a chance to. The junior title
February
match,
4th.
I thought was good, but it was nothing you had to see. You know, it was Kotaro Suzuki, who you knew was going to take the L against Itsuki Aoyagi. But really, I guess what the whole thing was, I guess, what was it going to lead to? And now we know it's that Naruki Doi. It looks like he's going to get the next title shot.
And he's everywhere right now. As his shirt said, I'm free. He still is wrestling in Dragon Gate. He's in the Tag League right now, which is happening. Go out of your way to watch the main event from the February 3rd Dragon Gate show at a cheering Korakuen Hall if you want to see some good stuff from there. But he's in Dragon Gate. He's the he's got the, what is it, the DDT Extreme title or the Universal title in DDT. He's wrestling in All Japan right now. He's going to be challenging Atsuki Aoyagi. So yeah, he's kind of he's the guy that's going to be everywhere this year, including, as we said, teaming with Minoru Suzuki in All Japan.
When he started in Dragon Gate, was he? No. Who was second base? Remember that?
No, I don't.
This is going back to, you know, literally, Jesus Christ, 2005, 2003, 2004, whatever it was. He had a baseball gimmick, right? Was he, damn it, what was it? I think it was Second Doi, because he played for the Giants, right?
I'll take your word for it.
This is going to bother
me. While you look that up, I'm just going to briefly mention that.
Pulling Alvarez here, sorry.
The All Japan show coming up at Korakuen next weekend on the 19th, not this weekend coming up in a few days, but next weekend, pretty damn interesting in that you've got Kento Miyahara defending the Triple Crown against Yuji Nagata, who, yes, Yuji Nagata is New Japan, but he's been spending the majority of his time in All Japan the last 6 months or so. You mentioned Atsuki Aoyagi against Naruki Doi, but there's a bunch of other New Japan involvement on this show. Suwama and the Saito brothers against Yuto Nakashima, Ryohei Oiwa, and Kosei Fujita. We've got Oscar Loibe teaming up with the 7-footer Ren Ayabe, who we've talked about coming out of JTO, a guy who sure seems like could be a fit in several promotions in a few years. They're both teaming with Shuji Ishikawa against Takao Omori, Toru Yano, and Black Menso Ri.
My God.
And then Shotaro Ashino, Ryuki Honda, and Misao Hanabata, the former Seigo Tachibana, taking on Yoshitatsu, Ryusuke Taguchi, and Master Wato. So a lot of New Japan contracted talent on that show, not to mention a pretty damn interesting match on the undercard as well, with Yuma Aoyagi and Naoya Nomura taking on Minoru Suzuki and Hokuto Omori. So some interesting stuff to look out for there as well.
It was a family member of his that played for the Yomiuri Giants, but he was second doi. If you go back and watch the old Dragon Gates that had the cartoon opening, you'll see somebody laying down a bunt in the beginning. That would be Naruki Doi. And yeah, apparently, according to Dragon Gate here, at the end of 2004, he just abruptly dropped the baseball gimmick and started appearing under his real name. I kind of remember that happening, but I also remember him a lot more with Blood Generation once he joined up with SEMA.
Yeah, I think that change worked out pretty well.
Pretty good, yeah.
Before we get to the Stardom show, which I definitely want to spend some time talking on, one to also briefly mention, because I think this happened between the last time we did a show and now, but it wasn't like the last few days. If you haven't had a chance yet to watch the Yuji Hino Kazusada Higuchi match from DDT Korakuen Hall, January 29th on Wrestle Universe, good Lord, they beat the holy hell out of each other, primarily with chops, but lariats as well. Like, I can't recall, maybe since that insanely hard-hitting match between, was it Dylan James and Yuji Okabayashi the year before the pandemic started in the Champion Carnival, just in like a hotel ballroom in All Japan. This was the most disturbingly hard-hitting match I've seen since then. Wild stuff. Did not expect Yuji Hino to end Higuchi's reign, but that's something to go out of your way to watch.
This is how you know pro wrestling is a work, folks. There's no way these two guys could have kicked the shit out of each other for 27 minutes in real life, because I tell you what, they were... those bombs, oh my God. And because, look, Higuchi was my champion, so I guess this now makes Yuji Hino my champion, because it was a really goddamn good match.
It was. It's one of those that there'll be so much great wrestling throughout the year, and there already has been. It's going to be one of those that will be largely forgotten, but it shouldn't be. It was great. Other quick note from that show, we've talked about New Japan and the idea of, you know, speeding up the Young Lion process. You know, there's different ways to bring young wrestlers along. We've talked about that, you know, in Dragon Gate, how great wrestlers are almost immediately out of the chute. It's worth mentioning in DDT, they're doing this D-Generations Cup. Not D-Generation X, but D-Generations Cup. If you've never seen Takeshi Masada, which you might get confused with Masashi Takeda, not the same guy, not a deathmatch guy. This guy only has a few months experience. He is incredible already. He wrestled Keigo Nakamura in a B-Block match on this show, but... like a fully formed look. He's got a great look. He's got size. Execution is great. He does some really unique strikes. Just a shockingly, shockingly great wrestler for the very limited experience that he has so far. So wanted to mention that, Mike, before we go headlong into the Stardom Supreme Fight Show, because talk about cheering crowds finally. Man, it was good to hear crowds cheering at a Stardom show.
Oh, so I guess you don't want me to go through my full review of the Noah show and Iho Dr. Wagner Jr.'s national title defense.
Oh, we'll get there. We can talk about that first if you want, because...
Well, here's why. I'll just get it out of the way. It was an all right match. It was okay. You know, I am obviously far more bullish on Dr. Wagner Jr. than a lot of you guys are, including yourself, sir.
But I thought it was good. I've come around to him a little bit lately, and I thought this was really fun.
It was Soya slapping meat. You know what I'm saying? Like they worked the match the way they should have worked it. You know, it was more, you know, And look, Dr. Wagner Jr. is not exactly the most spry luchador you've ever seen in the world either. God knows, I don't even know how old he is right now. But, you know, he and Soya, I thought, worked the right way. And I thought it was, I thought, again, this went 20, did not need to go that long, but it was pretty damn good. 825 is what they're saying. You know, I don't know if that's what was in there or not, but, you know, to go with that as the main event on essentially a show where I guess most of the attention was on the elimination match, and I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, I thought the match was good. I think watching this show with a cheering crowd, Cork and Hall, it was very clear that no company has needed the return of cheering fans more than Pro Wrestling Noah.
Yeah.
You know, not all clap crowds are created equal, and Noah crowds just didn't do anything at a lot of these shows. You didn't even have like clap runs. Like it was very dead. A lot of these Corican shows with some good stuff, but nothing blow away, no real marquee matches, just were a chore to get through. The crowd was really into it. 825 for Noah is really good for this being the main event compared to what they've done. I feel like almost anything they've done at Corican over the past couple of years, it struggles to get over 400, 450, 500
tops. That's it,
because
that's what I was thinking. Like, even if they're lying to me, it's like, when I saw the number, it's like, eh. But it's like, and then I saw the show, but it's like, even if they're lying about the number, at least you can get close enough to it where you can lie about that number as opposed to having 350 people there and trying to say it's 700.
It was definitely significantly more people than on those really small crowd shows that we were talking about. So that's a very good point. You also had GLG dropping a fall to Kiyomiya Sugiura and Mara Fuji. It looks like they might be building to either Jake Lee against Sugiura or Mara Fuji. Obviously, we've got Kaito Kiyomiya and Jack Morris coming up this weekend at Edion Arena. Really the only major matches, even though it's a big show, it's Kaito Kiyomiya and Jack Morris for the GHC title, Sugiura and Kojima defending against Kitamiya and Daiki Inaba. Drillistico's debut in Noah, a junior tag title match, but really a lot of pressure on Kiyomiya and Jack Morris to deliver not only in ring, but you know, it'll be kind of a referendum of where Kiyomiya is at as a star, because there's really nothing to prop him up or shield him from a potentially bad gate here. It's all on that. Also, I didn't even realize this until just looking at the card. El Desperado, you talk about him going from promotion to promotion or globetrotting, he's teaming with Nosawa here against Yohei and Seiki Yoshioka.
Naturally.
So I guess a little bit of a lead into about a week and a half later where he'll be a part of the big Muto show. But yes, with all that Noah talk out of the way, let's dig deep before we close the show out on the Stardom show, Supreme Fight, Osaka Edion Arena. It appeared like in this building, as opposed to some of the other buildings right now, there still were social distancing restrictions, like at least on the floor, there is, you know, a seat between everybody. It's listed as 1,832 fans. I mean, whenever I see a promotion, you know, outside of New Japan or Dragon Gate really running like a bigger arena like this, for me, when I just look at the building and I think, was it worth it to run this big building? If I can see a decent number of people in the balcony, in addition to the floor being full, then I feel like, yeah, this doesn't feel empty and weird. It was the right call running the building. And there were a decent number of people in the balcony. So to me, from an attendance standpoint, visually, it looked fine.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything to really complain about there, you know, when it comes to that. How many people were actually really there? I don't know. What did they claim? 1832?
They claimed 1832, and the floor, while social distance, was full.
Yeah.
And then you did have in the upper deck, there were some sections where, like, social distance-wise, it looked full. You had some sections where it was a smattering. Like, in a building that holds 6,000, look, just eyeballing it, I don't have any problem believing that that's a legit number.
No, and I don't have any problem with that. And you know how they did on pay-per-view, I don't know. I was, compared to the last couple of pay-per-views, it just seemed to be, and granted my timeline, there's a lot of mutes and blocks on it, but just, it didn't, I thought that there would be a little bit more buzz because, you know, I just think everybody's in the tank for Suzuki and Julia like we are. But I don't know if it was just the timing or what it was, but it felt like that there was a little less buzz on this show and coming out of it than the past couple. And granted, look what they've been coming after, you know, some of the stuff that they had. So it, you know, I'm not shocked that there's a little bit of a dip here, but I was a little surprised for the lack of buzz coming out of it, especially because, you know, Julian Suzuki, like that was exactly what I wanted to see. And I thought that was great performances, or at least really good performances from both that sets up something, you know, again, for Suzuki much further down the line.
Yeah, I thought, I mean, I definitely saw a little bit more discussion than you did, but you know, I think part of it too is as exciting as the matches were on this show, the matchups going in, you know, I mentioned on last week's show that while I was really, really looking forward to Julia and Suzu Suzuki, I would have loved to see this be whatever the third, fourth, fifth defense, where in my mind I could have bought into the idea of Suzu winning more than I did going into that, going into this match. I thought the last 5 minutes of this, the last 5-10 minutes of this were off the charts incredible. Mm. Like, to me, if you tack on the last 5-10 minutes of this to the 15-minute draw they had in the five-star last year, it's really, 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 really high on my match of the year list, you know, a month or two into the year, and probably would stay that at that point. As it was still really good. I felt like it was a little slow getting going. But good Lord, just the physicality, the beating of the last few minutes was everything I would have hoped, you know, another Julia Suzu Suzuki match would have been. And then, you know, post-match, it sure seemed like we had Julia appealing as hard as she could for Suzu Suzuki to join Stardom full time. We'll see if that happens. But good Lord, do I want to see it happen.
Don't do it, Miss Suzuki. Don't do it. You got too much out there to do. As long as you don't kill yourself in some crazy match or something like that. But
that's what she
wants
to do.
That's like saying Darby Allin don't dive off some.
It's why she became a wrestler. I share your feeling on that.
I'd look at her and go, 20 years old, I want to see you for another 20 years. But you know what? She's just trying to do what she's trying to do now, and who knows how it goes. I get it. You're exactly right. Would I like her as much? Would I have been drawn to her as much if I didn't see her doing what she's doing? But she at 20 years old, my God damn, she's good and fit perfectly with Julia. And I disagree with you. I get what you're saying about the third, but I like this as Julia's first defense because there was no question. No, hey, this wasn't about really Suzuki winning the belt. It was just, can you hang in there with Julia one more time? We went 15. We're going to tack another 10 onto it. How's it going to go? And goddamn, it went great. And compared to Kamatani and Momo, you know, boy, this was Nanae Takahashi and you and Micah and Himeka was excellent. I thought that was a really great tag team match, and it made me feel good about you and Nanae with those belts. And Julian Suzuki, man, obviously we just talked about that. Kamatani and Momo, if I never, ever, fucking ever want to see a bat shot delivered to somebody early in a match outside the ring, and then 10 minutes, not even, seconds later, you're not selling it because it's a phony.
But it's a wiffle
shot.
Ball bat.
All of the stuff, and I know you love it, and I know I'm in the minority on Oedo Tai, I don't like it. And I thought Kamatani was good, but it's like, it just, between those other two matches, I watched it again afterwards. You know, I watched the last four back after the whole thing was over because, you know, I'm a Chihiro Hashimoto fan. I just don't like it. I don't like it. It's too much. It's too much is what it is.
For whatever reason, it does not bother me anywhere near as much as the other heel stables. I think because sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. I thought, to me, the bigger thing here is I thought Momo Watanabe looked fantastic in this match. We don't see her get as many big singles opportunities as I think any of us would like her to in a perfect world. I would not say that I thought this was Saya Kamitani's best performance in her never-ending title reign. She's more hit than miss generally. And for the most part, I think she's a lot better than some people give her credit for. I think I might finally be getting to the point that some people got to a little bit earlier where I'm ready for this long, whatever it's 13, 14 defense white belt reign to be over. I just feel like on those occasions where she's off, she's really off. And that appeared to be the case here. The 450 splash finish didn't quite work. She didn't land it great. It almost looked like Momo got the knees up, but then that isn't what happened. It was kind of surprising as well that Kamitani left without a new challenger. We didn't have new challengers for Kamitani or Julia at the end of this show. And that may be, you know, you talk about buzz. That may be a bit of where there was not as much buzz coming out of it because you didn't have, you know, if that was the case, maybe it's because you didn't have those challengers.
Challenges, yeah.
You didn't have that really sort of, you know, laid out. And part of that might be because we've got the Cinderella tournament coming up, you know, and that's going to determine a lot of that. To me, though, the best two matches on this show is as awesome as the main event was, and it was great. The best two matches on this show were, as you mentioned, the tag title match with Nanai Takahashi and Yu defeating Micah and Himeka. And I definitely want to talk about that. But for my money, the best match on this show was Chihiro Hashimoto and Mirai. Hashimoto is great. I know you were saying, you know, how big of a fan you are of her. I'm a big fan as well. You talk about people I'm in the tank for. I think everyone knows Mirai is very high on that list, going back to her days in Tokyo Joshi Pro as Mirai Mayumi. I thought Mirai had an incredible showing here in a different way, but kind of a lot like Yo in the New Japan show where it... Well, to me, it's kind of both with this match, Mike, and with the match after. It's a point I wanted to bring up earlier that with crowds being allowed to cheer now after 3 years, we're finding out who really is over. And any promotion, like excuses they have about, well, this person isn't over, so we only push them to this level or whatever, all that is washed away now. And you look at somebody like Mirai. You know, a lot of people have complained, well, she's getting more pushed than her, you know, her level of being over really dictates. The people were with her from the beginning. They're with her throughout. As she was getting German suplex for the finish, they were chanting her name. Obviously, this was a match booked to set up the Hashimoto Shuri match, which will most likely take place at the big show in April. But the crowd was ready for Mirai to kick out a few more times and get a little bit closer to winning this match than she did. I just thought she looked fantastic here. And like I said, like I've been saying, I think in 3 years or less, and probably less than that, we're all going to be talking about her as one of the top five wrestlers in the world.
And it built really, really well. And that's the thing, too. I think if you watch the first couple of minutes and you're a little bit fidgety, you're going to be like, hey, is it really that? Just keep going. Keep going. Because again, like Adam mentioned, the crowd backing Mirai and them getting more into it as it went along. I thought it was really, really good. And Hashimoto is, she's such a great tank. Her
such
and,
a monster.
Oh my God. Her and Sarai, you know, obviously Sarai were, they had such great matches, and it's, you know, I don't know who else is left in Sendai. I mean, well, Christ, Mako's in NXT. So I don't know exactly what is going on there, but
you've got Miko Iwata still there. You've got Dash Chisako.
Well, yeah, and you technically and all, you know, and all the, yeah. So, you know, they're there, boy, goddamn. I've wanted to see her on a bigger stage for quite some time anyway, just because I think she is a great opponent for a lot of people. One, you know, she's just the suplexes and all that stuff. And I really, really liked this match a lot. I don't know if I liked it as much as you did, but this is one, too. Again, if you got some extra time to watch, you know, Julian Suzuki is the one off of this. The tag match is the two, but this is certainly the three.
Yeah, for me, I have this is the one. The tag match is the two. Julian Suzuki is the three, but all very, very close. The other thing that I found super interesting about this, just visually, whenever you see wrestlers from different promotions wrestle each other, like you have an idea of size in your mind. And Hashimoto, much like Kazusada Higuchi, is this, like, she wrestles bigger than she is.
Yeah.
Like, going into this match, I think you would think, well, Hashimoto's like 50 pounds heavier than Mariah and at least a couple inches taller. Standing next to each other, well, obviously they have different body types. They're the exact same size. But Hashimoto is such a beast that whenever she wrestles, whether it be against someone her size or smaller, when you watch her, it's like she's Vader out there. And that's, I mean that as a compliment. Like, there are wrestlers, and there aren't that many, but just with the aura that they project and the way they wrestle so much bigger than they are. Taz, you know, 20 years ago being another example of that.
Yeah.
This was great stuff. And 15, 18, the perfect length for a match like this. Any shorter would have felt like not enough. More would have felt like diminishing returns. This is exactly what you'd want out of these two wrestlers.
She's 5'2".
It's insane.
Yeah.
She's a monster. Yeah, she comes across like a monster.
It's like Randy Savage. You know, he would raise his arms up, and then it's like, you know, it's almost like the peacock feathers would come out. But the reality is, it's like, Savage was not that big. I don't know exactly, but it's like he was not that big. You know, granted, he blew himself up to a little bit of a bigger thing, but he always wrestled bigger. Always, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Projected. Much
yes.
bigger than they were. And I think Hashimoto has that quality. And, man, she's still young, and she's got so much time in where I, you know, her coming over to the States to do a tour, I think, you know, would I like it? Yeah. Do I think she would get over here right off the bat? No, I don't. I think you would have to put her
in. She would. If she's throwing people around with these suplexes and just knocking people down, I mean, maybe not on like a – in AEW right away, but you put her on a prestige show or something like
Defy
that.
Or West Coast Pro. I think that's the thing. She, if you brought her over and did something, I think she maybe could, but to me, it's again, just she with more exposure, with getting more and just again, stardom right now, it's stardom and everybody else. So boy, she would be a nice fit there, especially because they have so many princesses and so many smaller people that you would think are much smaller than her, certainly body type wise, you know, much more narrow than she is. But again, she's just such a great presence. I'm so happy to see her there. I was happy to see this match. I was happy that it was as good as it was, but me want more, please. And I want Saray to get out of whatever.
Oh God.
You know, hell that
she's purgatory
in.
She's
yeah.
in.
Visa wise
lost
right
inside
now.
That necklace amulet or whatever it is and can't
get
out.
Went through the damn portal and never came back out again. But, you know, Gallus is returning. Mako Satomura is now going to be on TV, apparently coming up next week. So hopefully any issues that have been had with visas during the time of COVID isn't going to be something strapped down to the end of a deal, because Saray has got to be, has it been 3 years or whatever they usually sign people to? Get
it
her
feels
the
like it.
Fuck out of there, please.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many possibilities, whether it be her wrestling elsewhere in the United States or obviously.
And I got tired of seeing Hashimoto Saray matches because they had so goddamn many of them. But it's like now I will never speak ill again.
Well, that's one of the great things that you mentioned with Hashimoto. We talked about Suzu, whether she signs with Stardom or not. The fact that Stardom is working with so many different promotions. And we talk about Haruka Umasaki being a semi-regular as well while not being contracted. Like, it's awesome to see so many different people coming through, and it's going to keep what is already a large roster. It's going to keep shows very fresh. The other match of significance on this show that we've kind of danced around the edges of and talked about how great it was, that being the Nai Takahashi and Yu defeating Micah and Himeka. The match was great. The structure was super unique in that Himeka goes for that running high knee off the apron and, you know, has the worked injury to her knee, which felt legit at first, but the match just worked around that just brilliant throughout that. But the most noteworthy thing, going back to the point I had about cheering crowds and it really telling people who's over, Micah and Himeka were beloved, absolutely beloved by the crowd in Osaka. They desperately wanted these two to win, cheering, chanting for them throughout. It was super cool to hear because, I mean, really, almost their entire time, if not their entire time in Stardust, in clap crowd only. And you're like, well, they're upper mid card people that could be main eventers, but you just hear claps, so you don't know how the crowd feels. They were in love with Micah and Himeka here.
Why would they not be? They should be.
Agreed.
I'm in love with both of them. I think they're a great team. I think Himeka is going to be a top singles champion, I think, at some point.
I hope so. I desperately hope so.
She fits perfectly. And I look, if they stay a tag team forever, I'll be fine with that too, because I think they are great together. I think the team of Nane and you, this was so good. I thought it was worked really well. You talked about the knee. It's just the ebbs and flows of the whole thing, I thought, went really good. And this was another one. It went nearly 20 minutes. It never felt like it. And it was getting towards the end there. It's like, man, are Micah and Emeka, are they really going to win this? And no, they did not. But I thought it was a really, really good match. And they left the door open if you want to do it again. Obviously, they're probably not. But I really enjoyed this. And it made, look, again, this, I was not jumping over hoops over Nane and you and this whole Neo Stardom Ladies Army thing. But
no, neither was I.
You keep doing this? I'm completely fine with it.
Well, yeah, and I think it still feels like we're hurtling headlong toward the big show in April, All-Star Grand Queendom 2023. I mean, it just might be headcanon that I'm trying to book into reality, but I don't see any way that this doesn't end with, at that show, Meltier getting their rematch and winning the tag titles back. We had Ruaka and Natsuko Tora come out and issue a challenge for the next tag title shot, which will take place at Korakuen on March 10th. And I'm actually super hyped for that because, like we talked about before, I was kind of dreading, I think we were both kind of dreading Natsuko Tora. Like, we're happy she was coming back, obviously thrilled she came back from that disastrous knee injury, but we're dreading the matches based off of kind of what you talked about earlier, just the heavy-handedness of the Uedo Tai interference in her matches pre-injury. But her and Ruaka were awesome together in the tag league. And this can be another really fun hoss fight sort of match that obviously they're not going to win, but it gives 7-Up another title defense on the road to, I would think, like I said, losing at the big show in Yokohama in April.
I thought that Tora was going to win the roulette. I really did.
Oh yeah, yeah. The Naniwa roulette singles elimination belt challenge right match, which Saki Kashima of all people won.
It was so wacky because there was the 5-minute time limit, and they had the raw roulette, you know, gimmick on the screen. They had the wheel going around. It was like, well, Mayu, you know, came out. It was Mayu and Waka Tsukiyama to start it off. And it's like, well, does Mayu cruise through this whole thing? Does she stay in there for the entire thing? And, you know, she looked like it was going to be for a little while, but then she went to a draw with Tam. And then, you know, from there, it's like, well, you know, when Tora came out, it's like, well, this is what it's going to be. And then her and Hanzo Ohno ended up with a double DQ, which ended up opening the door for Fukigen Death, Billiken Death.
Billiken Death. We've had Gokigen, we've had Fukigen, we've got Billiken Death now, who eventually Saki Kashima got the pin to win the match with her Kishi Kaisei roll, which can beat anyone at any given time.
But honestly,
does.
For a second, didn't you think that Death was going to win this thing?
Oh, I absolutely did once it got to that point. The thing I'll say about this is this was so much more fun than like any of the Rambos that they've done, because we got like 5-minute draws. You know, we had the Mayu Tam Nakano 5-minute draw. We had the Natsupoi Mina Shirakawa 5-minute draw. Mariah May had another very strong performance in this. So I'm all for doing more of these and less Rambos. I also thought it was a really nice touch that the first wrestler out through the curtain on the first cheering show for Stardom after 3 years was Mayu Iwatani. I thought that was a very appropriate thing to do.
Yeah, I wonder, I guess that was by design, and it makes perfect sense to do that too. So yes. I thought that was really good. Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, Siri, Amisore and Konami. I thought that was pretty good, you know, for the 10 or 11 minutes that it was with Azumi Lady C. Oh, excuse me, and Adami Hayashishita. But nothing really worth going out of your way to see. I'm not, you know, Lady C is still coming along.
She's Lady C.
Yes. Saeeda and Ami Sorhe have far more upsides.
That's yeah, I would say that. Yeah, it's again, who knows? Because, I mean, Lady C has improved and everyone improves in Stardom, but I definitely feel like the ceiling is a little bit lower than it is with the other people that you talked about. We also had one triangle derby match on the show with Hazuki, Koguma, and Saeeda defeating Starlight Kid, Raka, and Haruka Umasaki. As far as things coming up for Stardom, there's quite a bit. As far as really noteworthy things, there's the next Stardom and Showcase show on the 26th with Shuri versus Saki Kashima in a UWF rules match.
And why not?
I thought we may have lost Mike, but yeah, that is a thing that's happening on the show.
They lost me with that, to be honest with you.
We have a What Will Happen to Cosmic Angels Captain's Fall match with Tam Nakano, Natsupoi, and Saki. Tam Nakano, obviously the captain there, against Club Venus. Well, two-thirds of Club Venus, Mina Shirakawa, Mariah May, and Waka Tsukiyama. Waka Tsukiyama is listed on Pearl Love as the captain of this, so this feels in some ways like the culmination of the story there, at least part of the culmination of the story there, with Waka having being given 3 months by Tam Nakano to either finally win or be out of the stable. I don't know if they'd pull the trigger on that in a showcase show, but that's, in any event, that's happening there. We also have, I know we both like wacky match names for shows in Japan. We have that here. Stardom, 12th anniversary, Stars versus Queen's Quest versus Oedo Tai, Raw, exclusive, high-class Kobe Beef Contest, three-way elimination match.
Love it.
So that's that. We also have Machine Legion versus Grim Reaper Legion as it's Super Strong Stardom Machine, which we all know is Saeeda, and it was actually hilarious on the was it in the Julia Gauntlet match on the 28th, where Julia is wrestling against Super Strong Stardom Machine and starts yelling for the crowd to cheer for Ida. But it hasn't been acknowledged that Super Strong Stardom Machine is Ida. And you can see Julia basically go like, oh shit, and start laughing. And the whole crowd laughs and it continues along. But it's Super Strong Stardom Machine, Super Strong Stardom Giant Machine, which is obviously Lady C, and X against Reaper A, Reaper B, and Reaper C.
Hey, look, I remember a time when these guys thought they knew who those masked men were and they pulled them off, and it was not Dusty Rhodes and Magnum TA's The James Boys. It was Tony Zane. And I don't know who the other guy, maybe Joel Deaton. I can't remember who it was. So.
Billy Black there? Joel Deaton and Billy Black. Talk about a magazine favorite team.
Yeah, really. Yeah, All Japan. God, man, that. Jeez. He had a really good run there. They had a good run there for a while, yeah, at least a long run.
Deaton in particular did sort of as like a, you know, a poor man's cowboy fall guy. And then Billy Black, I remember being hyped up as the American Jushin Liger in PWI.
Yes. And they would give him more shine in the non-Apter / Weston / whoever magazines it was, you know, your main events or whatever the hell it was at the time. You get more super color pinups of Billy Black.
Yeah, it would be like on one page, it would be a full color ad for Apartment Wrestling VHS tapes. And then on the other side of the page, it would be a full color career profile of Billy Black.
Flip the page over. It's some bloody picture of Chicky Star from 1987.
Yes, pretty much. I think that's probably the only ridiculous thing that won't be happening at the Stardom and Showcase show. Coming out of that, there's Stardom Tokyo Cinderella Journey 2023.
Now that's a circus. I don't know how they're gonna do this whole thing, but they have 955 women that are apparently announced for the Cinderella tournament this year, and I'm not sure if I like it. I'm not sure. Yeah, so I don't like this tournament every year anyway. I'm not a fan of it, but
this is prior to the Cinderella tournament getting underway itself. This is on the 4th, Cinderella Journey at Yoyogi National Stadium Gymnasium. It is the semifinals and the final of the Triangle Derby tournament. And then you probably heard me cheering, not clapping, but cheering thousands of miles away, Mike, or hundreds of miles away at least, as the Izumi Starlight Kid high-speed title match that was scuttled due to a Starlight Kid illness last month. It has been rescheduled. They're not skipping it, thank God. This is the best matchup in wrestling. Their match last year was incredible, and it is happening again. Izumi versus Starlight Kid for the high-speed title, March 4th, in front of hopefully a cheering Yoyogi National Stadium Gymnasium. That has been a red-hot building for crowds. If you go back to the last few Taka Taichi Mania shows. So I'm hoping they get a big vocal crowd for that, because that's going to be awesome.
Yeah, I guess winner gets Saki Kashima then, right?
Yes, exactly. Coming up at some point with Saki Kashima making the decision to cash in for her Naniwa Challenge gauntlet. Right. She's going to go after the high-speed title. So there's that. There is the New Blood Premium Show at Yokohama Budokan, which has Mirai and Tomoka Inaba taking on Ami Sore and Nanami. Also Starlight Kid and Karma, that being Haruka Umasaki's alter ego, taking on Mai Sakurai and Chan Yoda. Those are the semifinals of the New Blood Tag Team Title Tournament, which will also have the final on the same night. And then, as you mentioned, coming up on the 26th as well at Yokohama Budokan the next night, it's the beginning, the start of the Cinderella Tournament, which has a million people, including two exes, in addition to pretty much everyone you could imagine who's been in stardom lately. I guess noteworthy in that Tomoka Inaba and Haruka Umasaki, who are, you know, listed as outsiders, they are in the Cinderella tournament. But at least as of now, we don't see Suzu Suzuki unless she's going to be one of the two exes.
That's what I was wondering about, is how dramatic they get with one of those two exes. You know, if it's just going to be prominence, or are those spots being held open for, you know, not Mercedes Moné, but, you know, is a Kyrie, or could they use somebody who had been in stardom that they now can travel again, that could come over? I'll be interested to see what they do there. If they, what exactly the plan is going to be, if they do one, again, somebody from the UK or somebody from the US along with somebody from Japan, or if it's going to be a unit or a team kind of, or however they, you know, decide to play this thing. It'll be interesting, because Risa Sarah's announced for it, right? Everybody else is.
No, not that I'm looking at. Like, the list that I'm looking at, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe it's been updated since then, but it's Utami Hayashishida, Izumi, Hizuki, Kaguma, Momo Kogo, Tam Nakano, Natsupoi, Thekla, Mai Sakurai, Maika, Himeka, Lady C, Hina, Miyu Amasaki, Natsuko Tora, Momo Watanabe, Mina Shirakawa, Mariah May, which is another indication of how well she's doing, that she's been added to that to the Cinderella tournament. Ami Sore, Tomoka Inaba, Ruaka, Rina, Shuri, Starlight Kid, Haruka Umasaki, Saki Kashima, Mayu Iwatani, Saya Ida, Hanan, Nanai Takahashi, Yuna Mizumori, Julia, Saya Kamatani, Mirai, X, and Double X, and No, My Name Is Not Excalibur.
Tony Storm won this a long time ago. Not saying that she would be the one to come in, but I would really like to see Tony Storm back in stardom. And same with Jamie Hayter. I'd like to see a lot of those ladies go walk back in there just for an appearance or two and go back out again. But yeah,
maybe
again,
at least at All-Star Grand Queendom, if they're trying to make that this big multi-promotional festival of Joshi wrestling, that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah. This is interesting. Again, not prominence, not a whole lot of that. Obviously Inaba's in, so yay. I don't think there's, shouldn't be a shock that she's in, but still yay. So I'm happy about that. So this is interesting. I don't know, 36 people is a lot. I'm not a big fan of this tournament. I think it's can be kind of superfluous. I get it. I understand why people like it. It's just, it's not really for me, but I obviously they may be putting a little bit of a different spin on things here too, especially again with what's going on right now with all the moving parts all over the place everywhere anyway.
Yeah. It'll be very interesting to see how it plays out. I mean, to me, it's fun in that you've got shorter time limits. You know, you have got over the top rope eliminations in play. I assume that'll be the case as well here. So you get some different upsets that you maybe wouldn't have as a possibility if it was pinfalls. But
let me hold a gun to your head right now. Who do you think is going to win?
Oh, I think whoever wins will be the person to beat Saya Kamatani for the white belt.
Mina Shirakawa?
To me, it's either Mina Shirakawa or Natsupoi. I mean, to me, I thought the entire time that Natsupoi would be the person to beat Saya Kamatani. But then, you know, with the horrible injury that happened to Mina Shirakawa and how much momentum she's gained off that and just how great of a wrestler she's become. And now with her leading her own stable or at least her own subgroup, I've almost moved to the position that I would like to see Mina Shirakawa be the one to beat Kamatani. I tend to think Shirakawa will get another title shot, will lose, and then Natsupoi will win the title. So I guess, yes, if I had to, I would say Natsupoi. I always would love to see Izumi or Starlight Kid win this and go on to win one of the two major titles, but it just does not seem like that's where either of them are slotted right now. They both seem to be more high speed or tags or trios, so we shall see.
I want Inaba to win. I know she won't. I just want her to start shoot head kicking people. I love her. God, I want to see her in the mix all the time.
Who knows? I mean, I don't know that a whole lot of people last year would have gone into that tournament thinking that Mariah was going to win.
Yeah,
and they went all in on her, and it worked out very, very well. I mean, Inaba hasn't signed full time yet, but yeah. God, if not this year, I can very easily see a scenario where in the next few years she wins because she's great. And she only is getting better and better with, each passing show.
Queen
really.
Karate fighter. You know, it's just like the whole thing, you know, she's got her dress is somehow still a gi. The whole thing.
Her doing the full karate demonstration, like her entrance. Like, because they bring, after you win the tournament, they bring you back out, and you come out with the dress and the crown. And instead she comes out with the dress and the crown, but comes out to her music and does the same karate demonstration entrance once she gets into the ring that she does during a regular match. I would find that highly entertaining.
She does it so much better than Siri, too. Sorry, yes. Siri.
Yes, it's the one thing that the pupil could teach the teacher, I would say.
I do love, and that's the one thing, I said before, not a whole lot of buzz coming out of this or challenges, but we did have, obviously, the face-off between Siri and Hashimoto, and that is going to literally kick ass.
Oh, it's going to be incredible. And it's one of those things, too, that it doesn't need a title to be as big as whatever championship matches they have on that All-Star Grand Queendom show. Like, it's going to be right up there with whatever the white belt matches, whatever the red belt matches, IWGP Women's Championship match will likely be on that show with Mercedes Moné involvement. So, yeah, that show, it still is kind of simmering right now because we don't know anything of what's going to be on it other than most likely the Shuri Hashimoto match. But I don't know that people are fully prepared for how insane that show is going to be.
I'm glad we only did a 90-minute show today.
Close to it. We're under 2 hours, damn it. And there was a lot that happened last week. So over the past weekend, as we mentioned, a ton of stuff coming up this weekend as well with New Japan. NOAH Tokyo Joshi Pro as the finals of their tag tournament coming up about 24 hours from now as well. So a lot coming up, a lot to talk about on next week's show, but I think it's time to close this one out, Mike.
Yeah, and I got to be honest with everybody. I'm sorry you can put in your requests for it. No, on the wrestling news, we have not been covering the PsyQ Tag League in Big Japan. That is taking place, though. There are lots of other things that are taking place, but unfortunately, I just haven't had a whole lot of chance to see them. So
there's only so many hours in the day.
Yeah, tell me about it, because some of these hours, I got to stop talking about everything else besides Super Chief, how Wahoo McDaniel made the American Indian a first-class citizen over at Mid-Atlantic. Well, Jesus Christ, patreon.com/Mid-Atlantic Podcast. Yeah, I need to get back to work on doing that, which I'm going to do a little while after we get done recording here, because by the time Super Bowl Saturday rolls around, I have made people wait long enough for this podcast that I have coming up. The shoulder to the column that I wrote called Super Chief, How Wahoo McDaniel Made the American Indian a First-Class Citizen, and all about his 1984 heel turn in Jim Crockett Promotions Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling when he teamed with Tully Blanchard as the Awesome Twosome. Some called them the Gruesome Twosome, and he went at it with Ricky Steamboat and Ric Flair and ultimately Magnum T.A., but I have been working really hard on that. If you're a fan of history, if you're a fan of audio documentaries, if you're a fan of me, please support patreon.com/Mid-Atlantic Podcast, because I am greatly enjoying doing these shows. The podcast is looking like it's going to be about, it's probably going to be about 3.5 hours all said and done.
So it's going to be a short one.
Yeah, when it's in its, you know, when it's in its main form. But there's a ton of audio going back to 1975. There are clips from local shows, ads that ran in the 70s that will help tell the story of Wahoo McDaniel and why he was so upset in 1984 when he was going after the U.S. title and was ultimately stripped of it after he defeated Ricky Steamboat, which led to his battles with Ric Flair and his team with Tully Blanchard. But I love doing that, and that's why I've been so quiet on my other social media, at Mid-Atlantic Pod and at Semper Vivi on Twitter, where you can also find me. Other than that, you guys already know the shows. I will say this, recording a new Bulls in the China Shop with my friend Vin Forte and Fam and Cal and whoever else decides to show up for it, blackwrestling.com on their Patreon. Pay the one, pay the 10. But check them out. A lot of content over there as well, too, including myself and Vin going through old videos and a bunch of other old, a whole lot of wacky stuff. So that's pretty much it for me, Adam. I saw, and I was very happy to see this, too, because I saw Johnny Valentine's name in there. You got the new shows, Wrestling at Random, with you and Jeremy, are up right now.
Yeah, Wrestling at Random. You can go to WrestlingAtRandom.com or search Wrestling at Random wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at WrestleAtRandom.
Oh, man, just
random.
Go to their YouTube and see how many clicks their shorts get. Man, yes! I'm jealous as hell.
It's, yeah, Jeremy took it upon himself maybe a month or so ago to start creating shorts of the YouTube video version of the podcast and blowing up, got 1,200, 1,300 within like the first day they went up. So that's another way you can follow the show. You can go to the YouTube channel for the Wrestling at Random podcast as well. But yeah, on the regular show that will be going up this Sunday, on the free feed, again, WrestlingAtRandom.com, or just search Wrestling at Random wherever you get podcasts. We are reviewing the go-home show of Monday Night Raw leading into the Canadian Stampede pay-per-view from Calgary, which we reviewed that pay-per-view in Season 1, Episode 11 of the free feed of Wrestling at Random. But that's on the free feed. It's Austin against Jim the Anvil Neidhart. It's also the episode of Raw where Paul Bearer reveals Undertaker's deep, dark secret. Murderer! So there's that on the free feed. Last week it was an episode of Thunder. I'll just give a tease. If you listen to last week's episode and this week's episode, last week was an episode of Thunder from 1998. This week's episode is an episode of Raw from 1997. We review each. And there is a wrestler who is on each of those shows. You will never in a million years guess what one wrestler appeared on Raw in 1997 and Thunder in 1998 and back-to-back weeks of this podcast. But then on our Patreon, patreon.com/wrestlingatrandom. Last week, we had a listener, a patron-curated list of the best of Greg the Hammer Valentine, which, if you listen to our podcast, you know that Jeremy Deamer cannot stand Greg the Hammer Valentine, his least favorite wrestler of all time, the Human Intermission. So one of our listeners put together a 3-match compilation of the best of Greg the Hammer Valentine for us to watch, and I thought it was pretty damn good. It's the Hammer against Wahoo McDaniel. It's the Hammer against Roddy Piper in the match that leads to their dog collar match. There's one other on there as well. I can't remember. But so that was last week. This week, another one of our patron supporters who is at the Intentionalizer tier where they can choose something for us to watch, they chose for us to watch Greg Valentine's father, Johnny Valentine, against Wild Bull Curry from June 20th of 1969. So that is up right now for patrons if you subscribe over at patreon.com/wrestlingatrandom. I believe it's $5 a month gets you immediately opens up the back catalog of the bonus content, which is more than 100 episodes. That's in addition to all the content on the free feed, 4 full seasons, getting well over 100 episodes there. So if you need more content, if for some reason, almost 2 hours of hearing me ramble about Japanese professional wrestling wasn't enough, there's even more of me talking about all forms of wrestling with my close, longtime personal friend, Jeremy Deemer at WrestlingAtRandom.com.
Houston? Where was that one from?
That is from Houston with okay. Paul Bosch on commentary, subtly, or actually not subtly, burying Bull Curry for how ugly he is. He's getting punched in the face, and Paul Bosch basically says, well, that won't hurt him at all. Doesn't have to worry about his beauty.
Well, that's true. I mean, no offense.
It's true.
I know.
In the immortal words of someone who's been banished from the pro wrestling landscape, tell me when I'm telling lies.
Hey, well, if you do, we'll make sure we cover it on the wrestling news because I do got to shove that in there too.
There you go.
At Wrestling News AV for everybody on Facebook and on Twitter. But every single day, pro wrestling news delivered to your ears without nonsense, conjecture, rumor, or any of that BS. Just what you need to know between 5 and 15 minutes to get your day started, including relevant to hear anything you may have missed from wrestling that morning. I know a lot of people wake up like, man, you know, I don't worry about spoilers too much. Who won that Triple Crown? Well, guess what? We're going to have it for you. As long as that show was over by about 8 o'clock in the morning Eastern time, I usually have those results for you. So if you want to wake up and say, you know, oh, what the hell did I miss? And, you know, whatever coming up here, don't worry. We'll hold you down over there. Like in Osaka, you know, you wake up on the 12th, like, hey, you know, I didn't really care about seeing Hikuleo and Jay White, but are they both gone? Just listen to the wrestling news. I'll let you know.
There you go. And I would say there's a little bit of nonsense, but that's just because pro wrestling is nonsense at its core. Mike is bringing the news to you straight, but he's talking about The Fiend and Uncle Howdy. So there's only so much straight news that can happen in that straight news.
Much like ratings, there are just some things that the public has dictated we must cover, and WWE is one of those things. It's just how it goes, you know. Just how it goes.
On that note, close it out.
I'm about to cry. I don't want to talk about WWE anymore. I don't want to talk about any modern wrestling anymore. Can't we just talk about historical stuff?
So you're saying you don't want to do this podcast?
Oh, wait. No. I want to do. Wait a second. No, wait. Oh, yeah. It's time to go. Adam and Mike, Big Audio Nightmare. We shall be back soon.